Ihr hört den Inside Out WUK Performing Arts Podcast.
Was ist Performancekunst überhaupt?
Und wo kann man sie finden?
Begebt euch mit uns auf die Suche.
Welcome to our first episode of our podcast in this new year. Happy New Year to all of you. In case you're wondering why I speak English today, it's because today's guest is Yossi Vanunu, the creative mastermind behind Toxic Dreams, who prefers to speak in English. Yossi, yesterday was the premiere of The Dead Class, the new piece by Toxic Dreams. Can you tell us in three or four sentences what it is about?
The Dead Class is a musical, or sort of a musical, that is built from text that was written in a manifesto form by a young man who shot their class. That's kind of the basic premise of it.
And the result is a rather intense piece, which made me personally almost crying, and I was scared all the time. Because it's interesting to see five young men on stage singing about how they feel as a loser, as a zero, as someone whose society doesn't understand. Why were you interested to bring those stories on stage?
I was reading a book on a wider context, where school shooter was were analyzed as a phenomena of a certain thing that is going on around young people. So I started to dive into it, and I was while researching, I came in all of this idea of the manifestos, and the more I read about it, the more I had the feeling that this phenomena has something to teach us that is bigger than just the act of school shooting, that the fact that this phenomena exists among certain young people, it's a sign, or it's a stand-in for a bigger problem. So, for example, when you start to research it and you think why it's only young men and not girl, and then you realize because girls tend to commit suicide and not to shoot the class, but the actual problem exists in girls and is in boys in that sense, that this disillusion, this not feeling adequate, this feeling like a loser. With girls, it has a lot to do with a certain physical appearance, with the way they are treated in the social media or social networks. And boys, or some boys, not all of them, of course, very small percentage of it, take it out on other. So for me, when I read it, I thought, okay, there is a story here that can shed much more light about where we are right now in our society, and also where we arrived with a certain decision that we made. How to run society, how to run our economy, how to run our education. And this is unfortunately the bad fruit of it.
And the piece is based on real manifestos by school shooters. How was it for you to work with this text?
Yeah, it's quite difficult, but it's also confusing. You can trace the beginning of manifesto to in that form to the Columbine shooting in Colorado. Of course, before that there was school shooting, and young men wrote either manifesto or diaries, however you want to call it. But something happened in the end of the 90s, beginning of the 21st century, that the internet, suddenly made this ability to publish something in a much larger scale. It made it into a real thing, into a real phenomena. And the moment the Columbine manifesto came out, other shooters started to relate to it. And so there was this feeling, or there is this feeling now, that the kind of over the last 20, 25 years, they keep on writing one manifesto that is a sort of a collective text by all of this disillusioned youngster, and they refer to each other. So, for example, there was a couple of years ago, there was a shooter in Florida that referred to the Columbine, whatever. So it's almost like they're writing their book of disillusion, they're writing their book of anger, they're writing their book of frustration. So there's a lot of repetition there. In terms of the thing itself, when you dive into the biographies on each one of them, it's quite an interesting story. When you look at the texts end up being very, very, very similar. You can almost extract a certain language out of it. It has to do with not being loved, not having sex, and generally not being accepted and feeling like a loser. There is here and there some differences. For example, there was a young man from Finland who didn't have this social structure, but he was in love with American culture, and he loved the Columbine thing, and he thought that the best thing, the best American things he can do is shoot the class, because for him this is the kind of life that he wanted to imitate. But or the other guy, Andreas Bervik, if I pronounce his name now, Bervik, the guy from Norway, he had a total political agenda, anti-immigration, anti-Muslim. He looked at himself as the new crusade. But in general, and the more the American type, it has to do with feeling like a loser. Mm-hmm. But when you dive into the text and you realize why many of them feel loser, is because there's a certain expectation as a young man that you will get certain things, that people will talk to you, that you will have a girlfriend, that you will have sex, that you will be successful. There's a certain image that this young man don't achieve, an image that's presented to them by media, by TV, by society, by social networks. It doesn't come out of nowhere. And the moment they realize that they will not be able to achieve this kind of status, the only way they have left is to take revenge. So in one way, there's a lot of reading it, a lot of time there's a certain repetition and you get the point. On the other hand, suddenly in a certain point you go into a very particular stories, and then you are totally moved or touched by them, because suddenly you see, ah, interesting. So for example, in the Columbine diaries, they call the Basement Diaries, one of them, I think Harris, talks about how much he loves his mother and father. And that throws you off, because you think, ah, you know, they come from a bad background, they don't like their parents, they have... And suddenly you realize, no. This young man really had a good relationship with his parents, to a point when you start to research, you see that his mother is giving TED Talks about... what does it mean to be a mother of a school shooter? On the other hand, when you go to another person, there is a story about one of them, the guy who shot in Virginia Tech. There's a transcript when he invites a pole dancer to an hotel room, and she dances for him, and after 10 minutes he gets bored. And he asks her to sit, and he tells her about the girlfriend he has, and Jelly. She's a supermodel and from the moon. And that throws you off on the other things about someone who invent a total different reality, including a girlfriend and where she is, and that he goes now to her. He shoots everybody and does his go to her. And then you start to research about him, and you realize when he was in high school, he wrote short plays. And the short plays are very sort of anti-capitalistic, anti-American way of living, written in a very crude language, but kind of an interesting. So this is the part when the reading all of the material start to be interesting and you start to familiarize yourself with the different people and also realize how different they are from each other. That it's not that easy to make a profile.
So, to put it in a more dramatic way, you can't say that there is one specific form or norm of someone who tends to kill other people.
No, the thing that the, not really, but the thing that the research says, and I read quite a lot of research about it, is that the moment somebody opened the door, you start to have a lot of copycats. So now we're reaching this level that even young men who don't feel the profile, who don't feel the psychological profile, started to do it because now it almost become a norm. And this is the dangerous part of it, that even people like, if you would have created a profile of this young man, this young man will not fit this profile, but now they're doing it because it became almost the norm. And that's kind of what I think is the dangers of the phenomena, that it became almost acceptable as a solution to a certain problem. It reminded me, I don't remember the case, generally. It reminded me, in one of the Pacific Island, there's a famous case, there was a book about it, in one of the Pacific Island, I forgot now the detail, there was never a suicide in this island. Mm-hmm. And then one day a young man from the Pacific Island, this specific Pacific Island, who fell in love with a girl, she rejected him and he killed himself. And that was the first suicide in an island. And after that, there was almost an epidemic of suicide in this island. Mm-hmm. Because the moment suddenly this wasn't an option, young people who, let's say, had a fight with the parents, went out and hanged themselves and when it became almost an epidemic of the island, I can give you the detail, I forgot the name of it, a lot of psychologists went there and they started to really research this phenomena, and they realized, yeah, that the moment somebody opened the door and suddenly in a place when suicide was never a possibility, suddenly it became a possibility, it started to use by young men even on cases that actually it was not justified. You just had a fight with your parents and you went and you did it because suddenly it was an option. And I think there is something similar happened especially after the Columbine, which was the first one that was really widespread in the media, also via movies, that suddenly this became an epidemic. This became almost permission to do it. That's why, for example, now there is this tendency in America, for example, not to publish the name, not to give them any publicity, so they cannot do it in order to get some fame.
Because in the piece, one thing these young boys are looking for is a name, to be known by someone, so that their name will remain and there will be some sort of statue to praise them.
Yeah. Yeah, because I think this is one of the things that when nobody recognizes you, when you are the one that nobody want to be part, when you are not invited to have, the main thing that you want to is to be recognized, to have a name, to be known. You know, the classic Andy Warhol 15 minutes of fame, and I think that they're violent. In our society, more American than Europe, but Europe also in certain way. In Europe, it's a much more political act. It has a bit of a different implication, but violence is one of the biggest tool to get notorious. It's almost even more than if you have a really positive achievement. We like violence. Violence is glorified. There's a full industry behind. So I think this young man recognized very, very, very fast that by committing this act, they will be known. Because the other way does not exist for them. That's kind of interesting. Like, there was now a case in Michigan not long time ago by this 15-year-old boy. The parents are now also involved. So I looked at it, and there's a video clip that he put, this boy, when he was 10, when he's trying to teach other kids how to play a certain video game. And you watch this video YouTube clip of a very soft boy with glasses, a bit overweight, and he's really sweet, and he talks to her, and in the end of the video he says, "And if you like my my video YouTube tutorial, write me, and even if only one person like it, I will make another one." And it's touchy in that sense, because you realize he just wants to be recognized. And when we live in society of likes and not likes and who's the loser and who's the winner, apparently for the people who feel like loser, violence is a way to go, unfortunately.
I think what is also important to talk about is, or at least I think your piece is about toxic masculinity as well. It's about boys who think, okay, this girl rejects me, so I have the power to rape her or to be violent against her, and the whole incel movement, incel involuntary celibacy, boys who think that the only purpose of women is to serve them. And for me, this is really painful to see these young boys on stage, and that they take every rejection so it's so intense for them. I think, or at least I have the feeling that these are rather sensitive boys or young men. Would you agree with me?
Yeah, I think some of them, not all of them, some of them are quite sensitive. I totally agree with you about this toxic masculinity, and I think that this is what pumps into their head via everything around, via the media, via the imagery, via the social networks. And I think that the more it goes, the more they feel entitled to it. But on the other hand, there's a quite scary statistic in America. I don't know about Europe, but there's quite scary statistic that almost 20% of men up to 25 are virgins, didn't have sex. This is scary, because this is a lot of anger and a lot of frustration. A lot of people who now have porn, have all of this sexual material that exists in the net, and this porn film, for example, give a very, very, very bad impression of what is relationship, how do you behave in a relationship,
how do you treat each other,
and I think this feeling that they deserve it and that they entitle it, become them the main, I think, the main way they look at the outside world. And then, of course, their idea, if you don't give it to me, I'll take it, which is not even what happened in the end. You have the rape culture and this aspect, but in terms of the school shooter or the university, because when we say school, there's a lot of college kids also, it's not only high school. There, in the end, they don't even achieve that, so they just kill and die. So they don't even deal with it in the end. It exists in their writing. Like, I used one text by this young man in California who seems to be well-to-do, quite coming from a very rich Hollywood family. The father is a producer. And I think he just fell in a certain point that it will never work for him. So it's hard to say if he tried or didn't try, because on the other hand, you can say with all the dating apps we have, with all of these things, it's very accessible. You can find somebody to talk to, or you can try. But I think that maybe in that point they already so much it's inhabited in them that they're just not capable. They fall in love with hate. They just love to hate. They love to be miserable. They love to be to feel like nobody liked them. They almost fall in love with being angry. And then there's not a lot of place you can go. So he goes there and he trains in his bedroom, and he takes a pillow and he starts to stab it with a knife. And when the police come, they found feathers all over, and there's a writing, and he says, "Who's the alpha male now, bitches?" Which is a line I use. Yeah. And you realize, yeah, he's just, he lost it. But when they go and shoot, when he goes to shoot, because he the guy in California, for example, he drives a car and he shoots random people from the car. So in the end, the revenge is also not specific. It's not like, and that's what the interesting for me, then, that it's not like they shoot the kids that hurts them, or they shoot the girls that reject them. When they decide to shoot, they go basically indiscriminately all over. And this was the bad influence of Columbine, because the two guys from Columbine from the beginning wanted to kill as many people as possible so they will become famous. Lucky the bomb that they put in the dining hall did not work. But they were the first one who said kind of who pushed it, the revenge should be on everyone. It's not about just the people who were bad to us, because that would be not spectacular enough.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to talk about the form as well, because mm-hmm. Making a musical out of such stories isn't that usual, I would put it this way. Why?
Yep. I mean, maybe here I have to explain a bit that we are in the middle of a toxic dream, in the middle of a cycle that we call real fiction. Where we deal with different show with this idea, what kind of structure, how to use so-called real material or real stories or stories that exist in, and put them into a certain fiction, which is mean a show. So, for example, when we did the Kreisky, that we inverted it, we took a character that exists historically, but we created a full fake biography. When we did, for example, Balulu, it was sort of like I took my biography and subverted it and created something that does not exist. So in all of the cycle, we are working with how language operate, and how do you play with this real fiction, and which format, and we do different formats. So, for example, the Kreisky was a sort of sitcom, and the Pereg was more performative when we took an existing material, and somehow I had this feeling, why not try a bit of a structure or a music piece, and see if you can take material that is relatively difficult and relatively hard and put it into a form that maybe will make it more accessible, or will make it more will make it easier to tell, because I think that in terms of the stories themselves, Hollywood or TV does it better than theater. So if you want to have an autobiographical story of a school shooter, you can do it I don't know if better, but you can do it realistically in film or in TV. In theater, it's much more difficult to do, because you know the realistic aspects of it is not really working well. So I thought, why not actually take it into the most sort of so-called artificial structure and discuss it via that. And that's why I decided to go musical. I also love musicals. I think that musical in Europe especially have a bad name because we have a certain idea of what is musical, but musical or the history of musical is much different than what we think. And especially, for example, in the last few years, you had a lot of musical that dealt with a kind of difficult material. And there was especially one musical that I dealt with in a different production I did in Vuk many years ago, the big event about the assassination of Kennedy. There was a musical by Stephen Sondheim, who just died. It's called Assassin. And it's a musical about all the people who assassinated the American president. And this musical is also always had a problem to make it into Broadway. Mm-hmm. Or And I love this musical. And this musical is also, structurally, it's not really a musical because it doesn't have really a story. It has a scene when you talk about one assassinate, and then another scene when you go historically from one assassin to an assassin. You start with Lincoln and you end up with Reagan or Kennedy. And that, I always loved this musical, and I thought, oh, that will be a nice way to try to tackle the school shooting. So it came both from a format, to try a different format, and also because I had the feeling that emotionally, maybe it will work much better if you put it with the music or if you put it in a song format.
Mm-hmm. And for the piece, you work with a young man. The youngest is 16 and the oldest is 25. How was this for you?
Yeah, it was interesting because in the beginning I was really worried because I'm used to work with the same people, and our team is actually also probably more women than men in general. And so I was really worried about it. I was also not sure how much I can convince them or make it work in a certain style that I like to work. But to my surprise, they were very, very open and very excited to do it. And somehow, we managed to create this atmosphere in a rehearsal room that in one way was very boy atmosphere, very, very men, because also most of the people in the band who are playing are older men. On the other hand, I have to say that the positive part of a lot of young people nowadays is that in many ways, a lot of young people are much more open than, for example, me and the people I knew when I was their age. So the way they deal with diversity, the way they deal with gender, the way they deal with sexuality, the way they deal with this topic, there's a much more openness and much more, I would say, willing to go places. So I was positively surprised how smooth it went and how easy it went. But I also didn't try to push them to go in certain directions. So I was very, as usual, because I do it also in with the performers in Toxic Dream, I don't push actors to do what I want because I never know what I want. I always take from them. So for me, it's always important that I get to know them and then I see what's their physicality, what's their voice, what they can bring into, and I build the show based on them. So if I have open people, it's very easy because then they keep on giving me things. So for example, if you take the physical work, I originally thought that maybe I will need a choreographer. And then when I started to work with them, I said, no, I will teach them a certain set of movement and then I will go from their bodies, what they can do. And it was kind of interesting how open they were and to try it and to bring their own physicality into the show. And it's just things to work. So they put their own bodies, their own self into it. And I think That was a positive surprise.
And the band or the orchestra, because music is always a crucial part of Toxic Dreams productions. And this time, working with a whole orchestra, I can put it in another way, because there are so many instruments and different themes and possibilities.
Yeah, it's interesting that there, for example, we worked with Martin, the composer, Martin Siever, the composer. We worked with him for a while alone. He was alone and it was just a guitar. And everything in the rehearsal room was very acoustic, very kind of mellow, intimate. And then suddenly, 2 weeks before Christmas, the full thing came, and suddenly the room was very loud. And it was a bit of a shock in that sense. You always have to kind of to realize in your head, but you always forget that the moment the full orchestra or the full band comes, everything changes and suddenly it gets a scale. It was very interesting. Took me some time to get used to it. I think in the beginning I had this feeling, oh wow, we're losing a bit the simplicity. But on the other hand, you win a lot. Like, for example, the moment you have an organ and you can have sometimes like almost these church-like sounds or whatever, it shifts a lot the meaning of what you do. And also, I think that as a director or as a maker, you lose a bit control, because the musician are much more connected to the composer, and it's almost like they work with him. So it's an interesting thing, because you as a director have little control about what they play or not. You can have your opinion, and that I find quite interesting, because it's almost like different artists coexist in a room, and people are putting their own take on the material, and it's not that unified, which I find very democratic anyway in work. So for me, we usually work like this in Toxic Dream, but now it's even more, because there's a full other group who is working on something that you don't totally control, or you don't totally sometimes understand. And I have to say that sometimes I even not so sure about some of the choices they make, but I'm intrigued because it surprises you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it's also nice. Yeah. To be surprised by music and how the tone changes and how the singers or actors present the story they have to tell.
Yeah.
Fine, then the Dead class will be in at VUK till Sunday the 16th, 7:30 p.m. Get your tickets at www.vuk.at, and we are very happy to see you there, and thank you very, very much for your time, Yossi.
Welcome.
And
see you soon. The next show.
See the next show, yeah.
Wenn euch der Inside Out Book Performing Arts Podcast gefällt, hinterlasst uns gerne einen Kommentar oder schreibt an performingarts@book.at. Der Podcast ist auf allen gängigen Plattformen online und wir freuen uns, wenn ihr ihn abonniert.
Unsere Signation wurde von Julius Werner Kromitschek komponiert und von ihm an der Bassklarinette und mir an der Geige eingespielt.
Das aktuelle Programm der WUK Performing Arts findet ihr unter www.wuk.at. Wir, Mareike, Franziska und Felicitas, bedanken uns fürs Zuhören. Bis zum nächsten Mal.